You're listening to An Act of Courage, a podcast brought to you by CapraCare, a global health nonprofit focused on bringing better healthcare services and opportunity to the people of Haiti. My name is Hethel Bauman. I'm your host, and I'm so glad you're here. It's been a little while since I've been in front of a podcast mic, and I'll be honest, it feels a little nostalgic. Some of you may remember me from my previous podcast from a couple years ago named Global Health Pursuit. That was a time in my life that I'll never forget. It was a time where I was able to grow as a leader. I found my voice through advocating for causes that are near and dear to my heart, and I learned so much during that year and a half. And if this is the first time you're hearing my voice, I want to say hello. How are you? You may have found this podcast while scrolling through Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Maybe you were looking for something inspiring, or maybe you were looking for a learning opportunity. And I want to say that you've come to the right place. On this podcast, we'll be learning together about global health struggles and triumphs, community and teamwork, and we'll be learning all about this through the courageous stories of our guests. So grab a cup of coffee, or if you're on your commute to and from work, or taking your daily mental health walk, take a breath, because in this first episode, we'll be taking you way back. This is episode number one with Jean-Pierre Louis, or JPL as we love to call him. He's the founder, president, and CEO of CapraCare, and in this episode, I want to take you back to when the idea of CapraCare was formed. This is the story of a young boy in a new land, in a new culture, a new language. A young boy who faced racial adversity for the first time in his life. This is the story of a young boy who realized the power of community, the power of teamwork, and what it means to give back to his people. Let's get into it. Wow. It's our first episode.
It is.
Isn't it so exciting?
It is.
I know we've been talking about this for a while, but it's finally coming to fruition. And I just hope that, you know, if you're listening in on this, this is so, it's just so exciting to us because it's almost like we're stepping into a whole new chapter of CapraCare.
That's right.
And you're coming along on the journey.
Yeah.
So this is the first episode and we're featuring the one and only Jean-Pierre Louis, JPL. And I want you guys to get to know him a little bit. If you've heard of CapraCare or if you've even heard of JPL, we're going to do a deep dive on where he came from, where he's going, CapraCare, and just everything. We're going to dive in deep. So JPL, thank you for coming on and giving us your time. I know you're a very busy man, but I really want to go back. Way back to when you were living in Haiti. You were born and raised in Haiti.
Yeah.
What was life like for you back then?
For me, it was normal. You know, the only reason why I can look back and realize how my life was because now I have an opportunity to be living here in the United States and can compare, you know, my life here, kids living here and kids living there. But for me at that time, I was in my world. I was in my own zone. I didn't see anything wrong with my environment where I was at. I was very happy. I was, full of energy, was just living until I left. And I realized, oh.
It's different.
It's different.
So what did that look like? What was your home like? How was your family? Well, tell us about your parents.
Well, listen, my dad died when I was 2 years old. Mm. So it's been myself, my mother, my brother, and my sister. That's us, the three of us. So when I was living in Haiti, I live in rural Haiti.
Mm.
So that means cow, goats, pigs, horses, donkeys, chicken.
Pigs, wow.
You know, a turkey.
And now you're living in New York.
Right. You know, so like any kid at that time, I had responsibilities. In the morning, I would get up to go get water. And shower myself and then walk back home to put my clothes in and walk back the same route I came from taking a bath.
And your water didn't come from?
No, it was a canal. It was a canal.
Wow.
It was a canal. I literally had to walk about a good 2.5 miles to get to the canal.
You did that every day?
Every day.
And wow.
Every day. Like, you know, two. Now I wake up, I have to go run 2 miles. Like, oh my God. But back then, you know, back then, yeah. So it was a good 2.5 mile, good 2.5 miles every morning that I had to go to school to bath myself and then walk back. So you're looking about 5 miles total, right? Just before. So I get my PE, physical exercise was done early in the morning. And then I walked back to the same route, you know, to go to school. But yeah.
What time did you have to get up in the morning for that?
Oh, we had to be in school by 8 o'clock.
Okay.
So that means I was up by like 6 o'clock in the morning to go do all of that, to get back home, dress, eat some breakfast, and then walk back to get to school. And then we had to get there before national anthem. So that means 8 o'clock. We had a bridge. There's a nice little bridge that we had. Once you get to the schoolyard, there's a bridge that you had to cross to get to the other side where we were all gathered for the national anthem. So if you didn't make it before the bell rang to sing the national anthem, then there's a long line waiting for you to meet with the principal.
Oh my gosh.
To be corrected for why were you late?
Oh no. Did that happen to you every now
it
and
did,
then?
Yes, it did a couple of times. It did a couple of times. It did. We would all be like, at least a good 10 to 15 of us looking at each other like, dang, oh my, he's coming. Because he's gonna discipline us.
That is too funny. And what about your mom? What was she up to those days?
Oh, my mom was a centrist, you know, very active, full of energy. You know, she provided for all three of us. There was time that, you know, she would drop me to school. So, you know, she would work with me to bring me to school and things. So she was very active, full of energy. That's my mom. My grandparents, on the other hand, same way. My grandmother, my maternal grandmother, very active lady, very business oriented. I really believe I got all my leadership skills from her. My grandfather, the same thing, very business savvy. He was a cock fighter. So, you know, it's how we made a living. We farm. My grandma on Saturday morning would saddle up the donkey with a bunch of empty bottles, and that I would, you know, be on the donkey and go into the city for about a good 7 miles, 7 to 8 miles, maybe a little bit more.
Wow.
With a bunch of empty bottles to go fill them up with produce, produce, and then to bring those things back. So she sold things like wine, licorice drinks, candy, soda. So I would go and get all of those things and bring them back on the donkey. So Saturday morning, that was my biggest task, because during the week, she'd be selling those things at home. And then when she goes to a cockfighting ring with my grandfather, I'll be left behind to sell all of those things.
Mm.
Yeah.
You had a lot of responsibilities back then.
I did. I even did some farming too as a kid. So on the weekend, those were the things that I got myself involved in. So life for me was pretty normal. Wake up, grandpa got coffee, grandma made coffee, grandpa got coffee. I go take a shower in the canal. I come back with my clothes on. She give me about, you know, a two or three goods to put in my pocket to go to school. That would be my lunch money. I come back home, do some chores. You know, feed the goats, feed the cow, and then do some homework.
And do it all over again the next day.
All over again. So my childhood was, for me, it was very normal.
So what prompted your family to come to the U.S.?
Well, I came to the United States around 1989. So during that time, there was a lot of migration happening because folks were looking for a better opportunity to live, because it was right after the Duvalier regime of 1986. So I remember the Duvalier regime very well, because in 86, I was actually in the street protesting too. Like, everybody else was protesting. I was there with my protesting. So no, whatever, let's make change, all that kind of excitement. Wow. So I was there in the street doing that.
And how old were you at that point?
Oh, I was about, 7 years old.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, about seven.
Protesting.
Gosh. Protesting. 7 years old. I clearly remember that day protesting. I didn't know the whole gamut behind the protest,
right.
But everyone was doing it. So I was in the street saying, yes, bring it on.
So when you came to the U.S., what was that first impression like? Because I know it was probably a huge culture shock, first of all, but then also, I'm sure, weather-wise.
Yeah, it was. But I was prepared. My grandma told me, be ready for whatever. She literally did.
Yeah.
Because I was leaving them behind, my friends, my family. It was just me going. My mom had already left already.
It was you went by yourself?
Yeah, I came by myself. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I was put on the plane to come by myself.
Oh, my gosh. Did you have, like, I know that these days when you're like a minor, you have like a flight attendant that helps you. Was that the same for you?
Uh-huh. It was the same thing for me. I clearly remember, you know, going through the whole process, you know, being checked in and then being escorted to the plane and getting there. And I'm just like, my eyes are like wide open, but I had no fear. My heart did not skip one beat. Because I literally remember my grandma saying, hey, be ready for what you're going to be exposed to, but don't be scared of anything. And I said, and I asked her, am I going to die? She says, because, you know, there's a risk, right? You might just get killed or something. I don't know. Because that was the most precious thing to me, was my life. So she says, no, you will not. And if it doesn't work out, listen, you'll come back. That was it. I was like, okay, well, if it doesn't work out, I'll come back. So I'm going to be all right. That was it.
Wow.
That was our conversation right before I boarded the plane. That was literally the conversation with my grandmother. I asked her that one question, will I die? She says, no. If it doesn't work out, you'll come back. I said, okay.
Will I die?
Yeah.
Wow.
That was the question I asked her. She says, no. And from that point, no fear. So now, whatever I see, I'm exposed to, I'm not going to be shocked by it. I'm just going to take it in and continue. That was it.
You had so much bravery when you were so young.
I did. And I think I really got that from her. My grandma was about 5'2", probably 120 pounds, you know, and full of courage, full of energy and strength. And she'll tell me all of these stories of how she was a businesswoman dealing with men in the marketplace when she goes to buy goods to come back and sell. And I've seen her in action. And I've literally observed all of those things in action, from my grandfather, to my grandmother, to my mom, to my uncles. So my family was very savvy in terms of getting things done. So I watched those things as a kid, and I soak all of those things in. And those are the things, those are the skills that you will not learn in school, but you learn through being exposed and being in that kind of environment. So I took those things with me when I came here to the United States. So you could imagine when I landed right here at JFK, and now my first culture shock would be, oh my God, the temperature. Right? Yes. So they gave me a jacket to put, a coat to put on. It was like freezing. Like, this was winter time when I came here in 89. It was winter time. You know, and that was the first thing I was exposed to, was the cold climate. And then I got picked up by my mother and we came home to Brooklyn.
So you guys lived in Brooklyn?
Yeah.
And how much earlier did your mom come over to the U.S.?
She was here about 2 years prior.
Okay. So she had everything set up. And
yeah. Can you believe it? 2 years prior, she was here and she got, you know, not speaking any English, having to learn and I guess work, find job and everything else. We didn't really have a lot of families here. When she came, she only had like a cousin or two who kind of helped her to settle in. And then within 2 years, she got us in.
And what does your mom do in Brooklyn?
So my mom was a nursing assistant and for home health, also a home health aide. So she had two jobs. My mom worked two jobs until she retired for like over 25 years. She had a night shift working as a nursing assistant from 12 to 8. And then her second job was from 3 to 11. So you would imagine from 3 to 8 o'clock in the morning, she was working.
Yeah, there's something to be said about immigrant parents, because I could say the same thing for my parents. They just, it's almost like second nature. It's like, yeah. Oh, yeah, I'll just go work. It's not a big deal.
Yeah. Work was, you know, there was no lazy bone in the family. I think that's one of the things for us as immigrants is that we are not known to be lazy. When we leave the environment where we were in and then come to the United States, we come to seek opportunities for growth and change and make impact for our family. So we come to work, we come to get it done. And those were the values that was instilled in me from a very early age. I think these are the things now that's making me work so hard to create a global impact for not just Haiti, but beyond Haiti through Capital Care.
Tell us about your struggles going through. I mean, did you even know English at that point?
No, I did not. I only spoke one language, Creole. No French, just Creole.
And so what was that process like, you know, getting integrated and immersed into like New York culture and English and all of that?
Well, yeah, the first thing was got registered in school. I was placed in the fifth grade at that time. So my teacher, I was placed in a bilingual program. So my teachers spoke Creole and all my classmates also were fairly new immigrants too. So they were either born here, but because their parents are Haitian, they automatically placed them in a bilingual education. Mm. And you know, even that itself, when you think back, like, oh, why would you do that? But at that time, that's what happened. If you were a Haitian kid, they didn't even care if you actually spoke English. They put you in a bilingual program because of your parents.
Right.
So some of the kids who were born here, but they were in a bilingual class. And some of the other kids were just like me, fresh new immigrants. In fact, one of my classmates came from Okai, same town I came from. We were both in there, right around the same time. We were both in the same classroom.
Did you know each other back then?
No, we did not. Wow. But we literally live about 3 miles apart.
Oh my gosh, that's so crazy.
Mm-hmm. Is this cross the canal from my hometown to his hometown? He crossed this, vice versa to my town. And we've been friends ever since. So we have over 30 years of friendship. We met literally here in the United States, came from the same area. And he also been volunteering with Capital Care too since we started. So it's like, hey.
You had that community just back then. Wow.
Yeah. So that was my first experience. And that's where, if you hear me speak often about, you know, my experience with being discriminated against, it was in the schoolyard, that same schoolyard where many of us did not speak English. That was my first encounter with discrimination, where now the non-bilingual kids were now calling us, the Haitian kids, you know, to things like booty scratcher, you got HIV, HBO. HBO was Haitian Body Odor. Mm. You know? And at that time, we're like, oh, you know, the HBO was actually a cable channel, right?
It still is.
But they used that against us as Haitian Body Odor. And all of that discrimination, I was like, I found puzzled because I didn't know where that was coming from. Like, why would the kids target in the Haitians kids? Because there were other kids from other countries too, right? This is Crown Heights, this is Brooklyn. But yet, the Haitian kids were the one being targeted. I was one of them. And I said, oh no, I'm not going to take that.
Yeah.
If you want me to go back to Haiti, I will. But I came here on a mission. The mission was to come here and get an education. My mom came here to find a job, find a better opportunity for us to live. That's what the mission is. But I'm part of that mission. So I'm not going to go right now, go back right now. I have a mission to accomplish. But now it become an extra motivation for me to say, yes, I am going to go back to Haiti. But I'm going to go back to Haiti now after I get this education and make Haiti a more productive place to live. So now that become my my motivation for my time in the United States. So I become completely focused. In fact, I'm actually very happy that I was teased, because it didn't set me back. It actually propelled me forward, yeah, to be even more focused on my education. No fighting or nothing, just get this education. And I did that.
It gave you a purpose.
It gave me a purpose early. And I didn't even think about all of those things, but it gave me a mission. Like I said, I grew up with my grandparents, so we always work and get stuff done. So now they gave me a mission. They literally gave me a mission. So I went to the junior high school, perfect attendance. I was recognized by New York City for having perfect attendance in junior high school. I went to high school, perfect attendance. Wow. I was recognized again by New York City for having perfect attendance. And then when I got to college, I actually missed my first class after my first year in college. Again, perfect attendance, very focused. And the only reason why I actually had my first, my streak was broken. Like, if you know baseball, Cal Ripken is known to have the longest streak of showing up to work every day, right? And play ball. Well, I was kind of like a Cal Ripken back then. And how my streak was broken was because one day I woke up and I literally thought it was Saturday.
Oh, no.
Literally thought it was Saturday. And the only reason why I realized it wasn't Saturday is because I was expecting to see the cartoons, right? And my mom was already at work, you know, that kind of thing. And of course, you know, I'm in college now, so I'm a little bit older. But I turned the TV on and I saw Jenny, the TV show Jenny. And I said, I'm seeing these different shows and not cartoons, like Saturday morning cartoon, literally. And then I realized, oh, whoa, let me go check. What's going on? Find out it's Tuesday. Like, how do you go from being in school on Monday and now here it is Tuesday and you home thinking it's Saturday? That's how my streak was broken.
I think we all have those days where we just wake up and we're like, what day is it?
That's it. You know, and I was blessed, right? Never been sick. Can you imagine from fifth grade on to past my first, into my second year of college is when I missed my first time in school. So I was very focused. So when I got to college, I said, I'm here now. Second year, you're given this book to select your major. And I said, now that I'm here, what's that major going to be?
Mm.
So I was in Brooklyn College going through the book. And then I read every single thing. Literally, I took my time to read every single major that you could major in.
Yeah.
I saw community health. I said, oh, and I read it. I said, oh, whoa, this looks great. This would have a great impact. If I learn this stuff and I master it, I'm good at it, then I can go back to Haiti and help transform the community through health education, through health. Because I was like, you know what? I'm not from a rich family. I don't have money like that. But if you can educate people, you could make great impact, and it shouldn't cost me a lot to do that. And I said, literally, once I get a job, based off my job alone, I can do something like this. So I wasn't even thinking about non-for-profit, for-profit. I was thinking of getting a job, get this education, go back to Haiti, use this, fund it myself. But and then that's what happened. So from community health, I did that, got my bachelor's in community health. Then I continued and said, nope, I got to do some more. And now I went in and major into public administration and policy and work for the Department of Health here in New York City. And through those experiences, I then say I was set out to start Capital Care in 2009 when I graduated with my master's in public health.
Back when you were a young kid, you know, like in fifth, sixth grade, it's almost like we said, it gave you all of that discrimination, kind of gave you that purpose. Yep. And then you had a why, you know, like if any of you read Simon Sinek's books or listened to his podcast, you know, start with why. Mm-hmm. And you didn't know how you were going to do all of this, but you knew what your purpose was and why you wanted to do it. And then it all kind of came together.
It all came together. And that was my why. I didn't know how, but I knew it was going to be done. A couple of things that happened that made me along the way that just knew that it was going to be done is because I played sport. I played baseball in high school. I played in the summer. I was really good. I had a vision of playing pro ball. So I knew through team, you can accomplish great things. So that helped out. But then after I did my bachelor's, I worked for the Department of Health. And in 2001, 9/11 happened.
Hmm.
So because I was working for the Department of Health, that gave me the experience to respond to disaster early. I was in Lower Manhattan working when all of that disaster happened, 9/11. So all of that gave me those first hands-on experience about responding. Now, mind you, Kappa Care is gonna start in 2009. So I had just finished my bachelor's. Now I'm working in a place that's going to give me the experience that I can definitely use to help, you know, develop communities, not only to New York City, but now it's the bigger vision is to go do this in Haiti as well. So you move forward from 2001, and then I enrolled a couple of years later into my master's program, and I graduated literally May 2009. But I went on a trip in February 2009. That was that trip to set off Kappa Care.
Did you know at that time when you said, "Okay, I'm gonna take a trip to Haiti, and this is when I'm gonna"?
Yes,
you did.
I did. Okay. I did, because for those 2 years, I work on my dissertation. I work on putting together a school-based health program. So the idea to start Kappa Care was to start as a school-based health program, because I said to myself, what's the best way to take care of people? Well, if you could start in a school, you could start with the children, then you could take it, you know, to their parents afterward.
Mm.
So we wanted to start by, I wanted to actually start by creating school-based health program based on my whole 2 years of researching around school-based health program.
Who were the first people that you met with? Who were your first partners?
So when I got there, the first thing I did was to go meet with those community leaders. Hey, how are you? This is who I am. You know, my family still lived there, right? My grandma was still living there. So I went and introduced myself and basically met all of those, you know, the local leaders. You know, this is rural Haiti, so they have all of their local leaders and everything else. And the good thing is my people know my family, but some of them actually remember me too as a kid.
Oh, wow.
It is. Oh, you such and such grandkids. You such and such son. So they know my dad and my mom. So all of those kind of give me some in. And I spoke to them. I said, yeah, I'm here on a mission to try to see what we can do here to basically help, you know, support the community. And I asked them questions and I introduced my ideas. And would this work? What do you guys think? Get ideas from those local leaders. And next thing you know, I start to mobilize some very young folks who are like 20 years old, 21, 22, just finishing college or still in college, because I knew I couldn't pay professionals. But I knew if I can train these young college graduate who are looking for job opportunities, and basically you have a country of 80% population unemployed, a lot of those in college students who just graduated are just sitting around looking for something to do.
Right.
So I introduced the idea to a group of them. And then from there, we selected about 20 to start Kappa Care.
I want to talk about trust in terms of the communities that you are serving. I think that a lot of times in terms of when a nonprofit comes into another country or, you know, says, oh, we want to do this or that for you, and this will help you. The first thing is really to build the trust between the person who is trying to, it's like a partnership, right? Where you're trying to build a partnership. And I think you had an advantage because obviously you're Haitian. You come from that area. people already knew you, you're credible. And so it was almost like, it was like too good to be true for them, because they were like, oh, he's part of us.
Yeah. And that's exactly what it was. The trust is a big thing, even to recruit those young ones who didn't even know me. Right. I had to use that. I came from the same schools. I walked the same streets. I took showers and baths in that same canal.
Yeah.
Okay. So, hey, but I don't see too much change since I've left. It looks like things that even got worse. But we can make something happen, you know, but I would need your full support on this. You know, so I leveraged my background definitely to inspire hope within them. And they took it on, you know. So here we are now. These are the same people who I inspire, who are now our partners for Capital Care, who are now our staff for Capital Care. We have staff who've been with us since day one, since the first time the local school opened up to allow us to use their classroom to train these staff. We got in with a pen, paper, and a Capital Care T-shirt and notebooks. That was it. There was nothing else. In fact, I couldn't even afford to feed them. So, you know, you're doing your training and you get your smart board, you got your PowerPoint presentation ready to go, packets. No, it was just literally a pen, a notepad, and T-shirt.
Yeah.
And I took a chalk and I go on the board and I start to write and start to communicate with them about, you know, what the vision is going to be like. In fact, I didn't even have those things mapped out. It was through conversation on how we're going to do these things and what the bigger picture would look like should you believe and want to support this work. And here we are now going on 14 years. These are some of the same people who was there with us since day one. Obviously, we have had new people who comes on board, but the average now time for the staff with Capital Care is about 7 years. And we're only 14 years old. And the staff now, the average age is about 33. So lots of young folks were eager to work. You now have, I have four directors who's been with Capital Care for about 7 to 9 years with the program, you know? So they grew with it. So they are the one who helped to put the infrastructure. So they are the one who helped to put the policies in place and, you know, the standard of operation, how we're gonna do our work, you know, the ins and outs. They knew we had like no technology. Now everybody has a laptop to work.
Mm-hmm.
But prior to that, it was just a pen and a pad. There was no, the office had no chairs, no desk, no nothing. When we actually finally was able to rent a home, by the way, and convert that home into what is now our clinic in Fort Fred. So, yeah. So we've gone through this transformation, this whole growth with the staff.
Can we just sit and just reflect on that? You know, it's been, you said 14 years.
14 years. So imagine this, right? So I go in and I recruit folks who have no experience in public health, no experience in mental health, right? So, and now you're talking about community development, mental health program, and so forth, and you train them. So all our staff have been trained hands-on, with the exception of the doctor and the nurses. They come in with some prior skill sets, of course, right? Knowledge. But some of our nurses, Capital Care was their first job.
Yeah.
It was their first job.
And let's talk about you giving opportunity to people there, you know? Tell our listeners what the percentage of unemployment is in Haiti.
80%.
80%. Can you believe that?
80%. You have a population of 11 million people and you have 80% of the people not working. That is madness.
Like, why is that?
Well, there's so many reasons why is that. You have political instability that's a constant. You have lack of leadership. You have folks with lack of vision who are controlling the mass. And you have a country that doesn't have too much, I would say, partner nation that really care about its advancement. And that's a shame because Haiti has contributed so much to the world, you know, and it doesn't have enough support. When disasters happen, the first line of supporters are individuals. you know, folks who have no connection with Haiti.
Right.
You know, who pour out their support and to send funds to help out. And that's who really support a lot of the work. The people in the diaspora, people like myself, you know, other NGOs, other organizations who are trying to do their best to support the people. But on a bigger level, the Haiti needs to have real friends, like, you know, a country that really wants to support its infrastructure through equipment, right? If you can equip the people and you could really support them in that sense with some real resources, not just food. When emergencies happen, disasters happen, yes, food are short term.
Right.
But you're looking at long-term stability. That requires skills development. That requires technology. That requires tools. That requires, you know, going through education, going through climate support, building better roads, bridges, building better homes. And to doing all of those things would open what? The number one thing that Haitian needs right now, jobs.
Right.
Because if you can do those type of programs, then you create jobs. And that's the number one thing for CapitaCare. Besides, you know, providing access to healthcare, our number one thing is creating opportunities for folks to work. So therefore, they can respond to their own disasters.
Right.
So these staff themselves, the locals, the community folks themselves, to be empowered through skills. We have 5 core programs in CapitaCare: healthcare, prevention, mental health, education and training, and disaster relief. Mm-hmm. But through those 5 programs, we use community members. We have a program called Community Health Workers Training Program, where we literally recruit members of the community to become community health workers, where they go through our training on how to respond to disasters, how to provide first aid, how to provide psychological first aid, how to provide support if somebody should have broken bones. So this is why we have been able to respond to disasters, because since we started in 2009, our first response, this is a brand new team, had to respond to a 2010 earthquake.
Yeah.
Now, we in Okai, Southern Haiti. The earthquake happened in Port-au-Prince. However, a lot of those folks in Port-au-Prince had to come back home to Okai, come back home to Fourfret.
Right.
So we then had to intercept those folks and work on their mental health, provide them with mental health counseling. You know, that was our first big intervention. And then you had cholera in 2012. Then now we have to educate people about, you know, hand washing, how to protect yourself, how to not get cholera, how to stay healthy. Then you had another outbreak in chikungunya, which is a mosquito-borne illness. So now this is why the school health program was so important, because we educated the students. Now we're sending our staff to the community to do workshop with the parents, to educate the parents, door knocking, sending our nurses to their house for home visit, you know, things like that. So, and then we had another disaster in Hurricane Matthew that happened in October 2016. We had to respond to that. I mean, the country with so much political instability going on, in 2018, you have this thing called PAYLOC, which basically shut down the country because of who the president was and the people they want the president to be there. So now you have massive shutdown of the country constantly. So 2018, you have that going on, protests everywhere. 2019, you have that going on, protests everywhere. And then boom, 2020, COVID-19. It's this one thing after another. It's like, wow, this country cannot catch a break. But here was our staff responding to all of these things. Along the way, we are constantly training them to respond. And then because we can only do so much, we now are training more folks in the community to also be able to respond alongside CapitaCare when these things happen. So lo and behold, here comes the big, massive earthquake, 7.2 earthquake in August 2021.
Mm.
Now, we now have about 25 staff to respond to this, but we have been training folks to become community health workers for a couple of cycles, a couple of years now. So we immediately, with the response and support that we were getting from foundations, from individuals, from partner organizations, because now CapitaCare is over 10 years old, we have plenty of partners. But the individual support that came in allowed us to now be able to send doctors out, nurses out, rent vehicle to now respond by conducting mobile health clinics, going to hard-to-reach areas and providing medical support, providing mental health support, distributing goods, food, hygiene kits, different kits. It was massive, massive. But yet their response was so courageous, you know. Everyone was inspired to get out and support. We were doing every single day, we sent like three teams to different locations to provide that support. So the past year, we have been responding to that. And here we are now. We're still responding because people don't recover from a disaster a year later.
Yeah.
You know, my hands-on experience with disaster was 9/11. And people, even now, you still have people who are still impacted by 9/11. Maybe their home is good now, right? People have places to stay or live and have stability. But in Haiti, you know, when you have all of those houses that was crumbled and crushed, people can't just bounce back and get like insurance to rebuild their home. That's not how it works. Some people may never be able to recover.
Well, let's talk about that right now. I mean, yeah. I know we're focusing on building homes to recover.
Yes, yes.
People kind of live more dignified lives, you
know? That's right. That's right.
That's one thing that you can, as a listener, can come and help us with and, you know, donate whatever you have. Every dollar counts. And then the other things that I want to talk about is feeling dignified. When you're able to respond yourself as a country, and even, I mean, obviously there are other countries that might come and be involved, but when you're able to feel empowered to help your own people, that's like a whole nother like sense of empowerment. And that's what you're doing for these people.
Absolutely.
They're not just sitting around and being like, oh, we're helpless, like, please come and help. No, they're getting down and dirty and helping their own people, which is so amazing.
And that's what oftentimes get lost in disaster relief, is that the locals feel that they don't get enough support to help to you know, get their hands dirty.
Yes.
No one wants to sit around and find like a big mission team comes in and doing all the work. They want to be involved.
Right.
And doing it. And that's one of our strengths, is that we get them involved in helping to distribute and helping to organize support. We get them involved in responding. When the earthquake happened last year in 2021, I did not bring a mission team to Haiti. I did not. When folks reach out and wants to go, I said, no, that money that you're going to pay for room and board transportation, now you're going to put us in a bind to find a room and board, put that resource toward hiring more doctors, more nurses, more community health workers, so we could get more motorcycles to get to more hard to reach places.
Right.
Some folks were like, "Oh no, but I really want to go." But no, you. First of all, there are challenges. You don't know the terrain. One, sometimes the language is a barrier. But yep. those things are strength for local folks. So after they hear that, they say, "Okay, great, let's do that, JPL, let's do that." And they put their funds, they put their support. That allowed us to hire over 50 community health workers to bring them in. And now, mind you, it's not just not bringing them in, but we actually financially support them too, because they were impacted by the disaster. Their homes too were crushed and crumbled. So now financially you're supporting them too, you're supporting them with resources, but they're also being empowered to respond as well.
Yes.
You know, that's very inspiring. And oftentimes that gets lost in these disaster relief responses. But for us, that's what we do.
Well, yeah. I mean, to piggyback off of that, it's like when somebody says, oh, I want to come to Haiti to help. It's like you have to pay for the flight. You have to pay for your room and board. You have to pay for your food. How many thousands of dollars is that you could actually just help and employ somebody within Haiti on the ground to help their own people, you know?
So let's say this, Heto, it could cost you about $3,500 for about a week in Haiti with Capital Care, between all of those things that you mentioned right now.
Yeah.
But that $3,500 could support three community health workers for an entire year of work with Capital Care. So go ahead. So do the math. You're going to go to Haiti for a week. But for $3,500, but that $3,500 could support three community health workers to work for a whole full year.
Wow.
Like applicant. That's impact. Now, don't get me wrong. We when times are great, we do mission trips to Haiti, short-term mission trips to Haiti. However, our short-term mission trip to Haiti is based on three particular things. One, you're going to go with a skill that you could actually use to train staff. Two, you're going to go there, you're going to observe challenges, barriers. And then when you come back, you're now going to work with us, the organization, and say, hey, how can we partner together now to continue to provide long-term stability and support for what you saw as challenges and barriers? So even now, so if you don't spend your money to invest in locals to be trained by us as community health workers to respond, but you really want to go, when you do go, that's the kind of impact that you actually make.
I think there's people want to see for themselves, which there mm-hmm. there is a balance, you know, like for people to get inspired and motivated to help a community, sometimes they need to feel the impact themselves, you
Absolutely.
Know, just like you coming to the US, you were like, oh my gosh, I didn't realize life was so different in this part of the world, you know? Yeah. And it goes the other way as well. And so I think that's huge.
When we
talk about Capra Care, what are your three biggest successes since you started?
Well, one I would say is having been able to invest in our staff development, who are now able to take on full leadership of day-to-day operation of the organization. This didn't happen overnight. We literally train each of our staff. Like I said, when we go to Haiti for short-term mission trips, we go with a team that's actually going there to train, to provide support to infrastructure. So you're not just going there just to go see Haiti. You're going there to make an impact, a lasting impact, and then come back and continue to support that impact. So that's has been one. Two is our partnership through community. The amount of partnership that we have been able to have and continue to build to continue to help us to make this work viable. That has been very good in terms of our growth as an organization. And then three, the type of infrastructure that we now have to support the growth of the organization. So those things have been major. And I can't, you know, and I would add another one, of course, in the number of people that we have reached in Haiti for the past 14 years. We have provided over 350,000 service encounters in 14 years.
Oh, wow.
Through mental health, through healthcare, through education, for both parents and students, through disaster reliefs. So, you know, we have a lot. And even then, it may sound huge, but even then, there's so much more that we could do. If we can garner enough support, enough partners, you know, folks who believe in our work. And we have become, like the New York Times put out an article and listed Capra Care as a reputable organization to support in the work that we do in Haiti. So that's big, you know, not only to have the reputation as being an honest organization on the ground in Haiti that the people trust, but to also get that same thing abroad. Now, when we talk about, you know, organization that are Haitian-led, Capra Care is one of the first ones to pop up as a Haitian-led reputable organization that's been doing the work in Haiti.
One thing I did want to mention is the focus that Capra Care puts on mental health, because that's not something that many other nonprofits do, because I feel like a lot of other health-based nonprofits, they focus on tangible outcomes, you know, work. It's not that you don't do that, but you went above and beyond in terms of, you know, helping people cope. I remember we were talking about this a couple of weeks ago, where you were saying that people didn't realize why they weren't sleeping at night, and they thought they were crazy because they were like, oh, what is this? What's happening with me?
Mental health is a priority for us at Capra Care, because since we started the organization in 2009, we've been responding to one disaster after another. But I didn't even mention the assassination of the head of state in July 2021. And then you have the earthquake in August, like literally a month later. Like right now, there's so much gang violence going on in Haiti and the political instability in Haiti. Schools have not been open this year. This school year has not started yet. And school was supposed to open in September. Right now, they're pushing it to January.
Yeah.
And if all goes well, it'll open up in January. Can you imagine all of those students just not sitting home doing nothing? The level of frustration for them, the level of frustration for parents. Mm-hmm. Right now, you have inflation has devastated the local economy, has devastated families in terms of finding food to put on the table.
Finding gas.
There's a gas. Forget shortage. There's no gas in Haiti. So it's hard to find. It was costing $50 to buy a gallon of gas.
My gosh.
Like right now, you can't find it. So people are going back to walking, taking bicycles because people can't circulate. There's no gas. It's hard to find. So a lot of issues. So therefore, you cannot sleep on mental health. It has to be a priority. And so for us, whatever that we do at Capital Care, mental health is one of them. So when someone comes in to get services, we provide mental health. Not just mental health, but wellness in general. Lots of folks don't even know that we provide acupuncture, ear acupuncture at Capital, right? Through wellness. So our staff are trained to provide that kind of service. So our mental health is very robust and very comprehensive. When someone comes in to get health services, we definitely offer that support as well. And they get, acupuncture. They get some time to just relax and talk through their challenges and barriers. And that's something that is offered, to the population. And they have become very open to it. When we first introduced the idea in 2009, folks weren't as open. But when the earthquake happened in 2010, they were very open to it because now they realize I'm not crazy. No, I've been traumatized. I didn't know what happened to me, but they're understanding, no, it was trauma. And Haitians are going through trauma on a daily basis.
Yeah.
Daily basis.
It's just the reality. But for Capricare to come in and make mental health a priority, I think it's like a breath of fresh air for them. They didn't even know that they needed it at that point.
No.
Yeah. So JPL, we are coming up to the end. I have a few more questions. The first question is to fill in the blank. Okay.
Sure.
This podcast is all about courage. It's all about, it's called An Act of Courage. We're talking about courage in so many different aspects of life. And for you, I want you to finish a sentence and tell us what you think courage is to you. So courage is
a will to take an action.
Yes. I love it. A will to take an action. And what would that be? What action or act of courage would you want to share with your audience, your listeners today for this week?
I would say find a way to support the organization. Find a way to support our work so therefore we can continue to provide stability to folks in Haiti. Money is king. Right? You can't do great things without having money. You can't do big things without having big money. So yeah, we are going to ask you to consider financially support, but not just financially support a one time. If you give Capital Care $25 per se, that will provide support for about 30 kids in our youth program, in our after school program. That'll provide some snacks for them when they come in to spend the afternoon with us. But when you provide $25 on a consistent basis, let's say on a monthly basis, it now allows us to provide more stability for them. Because $25 one time means they get snack one time. But $25 on a monthly basis allows us to budget what kind of snack we're going to buy, how many groups that we can hold, to provide support for them ongoing. But not just that, but let's say you want to invest $100 in Capital Care on a monthly basis. That allows us to hire a full-time community health workers to support the community for the whole year. So mental health, $50 allow us to be able to have our counselor provide more counseling to folks in the community on an ongoing basis. And we need to hire more people. We need to bring more doctors, more nurses, more community health workers to be more hands-on. So I would say, please consider donating to Capital Care. Invest in our work.
That's what it is. It's an investment.
Mm-hmm. It really is. It's an investment. An investment for long-term instability. You have a growing population that has growing needs, that has ongoing needs. But one time is just that. It goes toward the greatest need. But a recurring donation monthly can easily be done on a website. You go on www.capitalcare.org and it takes you literally less than a minute to make a monthly contribution that's going to provide stability and support for the work that we do. And if you go on any of our social media, whether it's LinkedIn, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, we love to hang out there. You just put at Capital Care. You can follow us. You can share. You can comment on the work. But not just like, take one extra step. A little bit of act of courage, right? Share it. Share the page with your friends. Tag your friends to come see what inspires you. Put their name there and say, hey, check this out. Share this episode. Subscribe to this episode so you can hear other partners and other folks who come in about their work that they do and how they have contributed to what's going on with Capital Care and how they have provided stability. And you'll see how you could fit in. And if you have any questions, shoot me an email.
So that leads me to my last question. How do people get in contact with you, JPL?
Easy. You can shoot me an email, JeanPierreLouis@capitalcare.org. JeanPierreLouis@capitalcare.org. And we'll talk. Or send us an email at info@capitalcare. You can always call the organization at 347-723-1405. 347-723-1405. This is easy to get in touch with. And to learn more about the work, just go on our website, capitalcare.org, and you see. But if you just Google Capital Care, just Google Capital Care, Capital Care, and you see all the amazing work that we have done because of people like yourself that believes in the work that we do.
Mic drop. That was, yeah. If you weren't inspired by that, you have no soul. I'm just saying. But yeah, I mean, just come Google the website and learn more about us. You know, we're always here to talk and connect. That's what we're all about, community.
Yeah.
And thank you for taking this time, JPL.
Thank you. Thank you, Hedo, for your courageousness too, for taking this on to help inspire and help build a community of supporters, investors that will support the work that we're doing in Haiti for the long term.
Of course, it lights me up.
You are appreciated.
Thank you. Thanks for listening to this episode. Sometimes when I hear stories like this, I can't fathom what it would be like to completely turn my life around by moving to a foreign land. My own parents did it, and frankly speaking, I'm not sure if I'll ever be that brave. I admire them for stepping into the unknown just like JPL and his mother did. And just imagine, if he never made that leap, Capital Care wouldn't exist today. The team at Capital Care is working hard to create an equitable world, starting with our friends in Haiti. So we ask for your support. If you would like to join us, donate, or learn more about what we do at Capital Care, visit us on the web at www.capitalcare.org. That's www.capitalcare.org. Or send us an email at info@capitalcare.org. Make sure to join our mailing list. We can't wait to hear from you. If you love this podcast, please consider subscribing, writing us a review, and sharing it with someone you love. It helps us reach more people just like you. Until next time, let me ask you this.
what will your act of courage be today?